You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Jamie McCavity, welcome back to the show, sir.
Thank you.
Get hydrated, get caffeinated. We got a tight hour here.
I just did a workout and I got a protein shake.
Oh, protein shake. What's your workout
routine? So I will have my best takes for you.
Well, freaks, we're sitting down with the most profitable Bitcoin miner in the world. Is that how you would define yourself?
I would say the lowest cost producer of hashes. Lowest cost producer of hashes.
How does that feel?
Do you want me to give my honest opinion?
Yes.
It feels like we have won like a fencing competition. Feels like we won something that not many people really care about. Well, let me put it this way. There's a very unique dichotomy about being a Bitcoin miner where people who love Bitcoin and who have this big ideological alignment and feel a passion about it for one reason or another, distrust of the state. They're a sovereign individual that they have anti monetary debasement, whatever it is. Those kind of people are like, you're the best. You're the most badass person around. And high five, they almost like I'm a quasi celebrity in maybe two rooms three times a year. And that's nice. Like it is nice. And I was that person before I built this business, and it's cool to realize your dreams. And then there's like investors and employees and the general market, and the market does not care. The market didn't really care that much that we built an amazing Bitcoin mining business. And that's a little deflating, because at the end of the day, you want to make money. And if you want to retain really, really smart people who helped you build a great business, they want to make money too. And they have a lot of opportunity.
Yeah. Especially these days with the AI boom, the gold rush that we're experiencing there.
Yeah. We actually had both kind of employees in the company. There's people who sort of would not want to be a part of the company if it weren't focused on Bitcoin. And there's people who would probably leave the company if it's not focused on AI. So we're sort of caught in the middle a little bit.
I feel like every Bitcoin miner is these days. I mean, big theme the last 12 months accelerating through the first two quarters of this year is this transition away from Bitcoin mining towards GPU compute.
Yeah, to a certain extent, the crowding of the Bitcoin mining market accelerated the eventual transition to AI, just because you had difficulty increase in a way that was unconstrained by economic reality for a long period of time. And so that just made the returns and the past performance that would be used to justify further investment and growth into Bitcoin mining, it just made those economic cases look bleak. And there's an irony about it almost, which is that now that nobody is investing in Bitcoin mining of all of the US pubcos for the most part, and the market is kind of weak and unsexy, it's the best time to invest in Bitcoin mining, hands down, of the last maybe 5 years.
That's what I'm pulling up mempool.space here. It looks like in 31 hours we're gonna have a negative 10% difficulty adjustment.
Yeah,
and that's the one thing I've been saying behind the scenes too, because if you think about it, especially for these miners that are transitioning to GPU compute, there's a relative lack of investment in Bitcoin miners in general, but you're just thinking about the hardware that they're offloading. I have to imagine, all right, I mean, you don't have to imagine. I think it's pretty clear that ASICs are going to be a good buy, I think, throughout the summer, maybe through the end of the year.
Yeah, definitely. And this is really what I think Bitcoin mining should look like. I think this is, I've been beating the drum on this for a little while now. I think this is a healthy departure away from the previous economic paradigm, which would be you're upgrading your miners every 2 to 3 years. You're running them 95% of the time or more. There's a legitimate hosting industry that exists. Like that is, that should not exist at all. And the fee market is relatively stable in a 24-hour period. I mean, all of those things are, I think they're remnants of an era that has now ended. And the what I expect the new paradigm will look like is you're running ASICs for a very long time. You are running them if you are only one step removed at most from energy production, ideally co-located. I think you're going to see more and more co-located energy production and mining. The fee market will be very volatile because block times will be very volatile. And, you know, it's just going to be the kind of thing where the fee market will really materialize because there will just be a backlog of transactions. And that will largely correspond to the cheapest energy input in the world, which is solar. And or maybe flare gas, but in flare gas you have to build and maintain a genset, and I think that's a little bit challenging. But with solar, I do see a very cheap source of power, and that's when there will be lots of abundant hashing going on, and then block times will be slow when the sun is shining on a part of the planet where there isn't a lot of Bitcoin mining.
Yeah, and that's actually the main reason I reached out to bring you on, obviously an update on the state of Bitcoin mining, your perspective on where we are in the cycle. But I think more importantly, the last time we talked, it was over a year ago now, at this point, talking about sort of the generation mix and the state of the grid, mm-hmm. particularly in Texas and where it's going across the United States. And obviously since then, the AI narrative's really taken hold and it's become abundantly clear that there is not enough generation to supply the demand that we have for compute right now and arguably for the foreseeable future. So I wanted to get your perspective on how this has evolved since we last spoke and where you see it going, because it seems like it is being deemed a national security initiative now at this point.
Yeah, I think we chatted in 2024 or 2023, I still had really long hair. I cut my hair to a more medium length in May of 2024. That was like a little bit of an end of an era. And we were still in the Biden administration then. The renewables above everything else push was still going strong. You and I were talking about how power grids are weakened by too much renewable energy without an inertia presence, like a rotating turbine that can absorb changes in grid demand and supply very quickly. And just generally like demonizing the renewables groupthink. I'm surprised by how much of a 180 we've seen now with the pro-nuclear, pro-natural gas, and grow the grid at all cost top-down statement. And I'm also surprised to see, I guess I shouldn't be surprised, but it's a little bit wild to see such strong and baseless opposition to this stuff, whether it be like growing our energy base, fixing our grids, the same misinformation about AI data centers as we saw with Bitcoin mining. Like they're going to use all the water. It's going to drive up your electricity costs. It's just like so uninformed bullshit, and people are buying it. I'm saying, like, anytime I see them, like, that's Chinese propaganda. They are trying to slow down our data center expansion because they want us to buy all the AI tokens from them in the future. Because no matter what, even the protesters, they're going to buy AI tokens too. Everybody is going to be buying and using AI tokens all the time. You cannot put the genie back in the bottle. They're even making protest flyers using ChatGPT. It's like the most ironic thing in the world. and like, don't you want this to be built here? Don't you want America, the leader of the free world, where we still have some rights and civil liberties, and you could still push back against the state to a slight degree and have these great freedoms? Don't you want that to be the place that has the best AI instead of this authoritarian complete surveillance state where they could just squelch out any opposition? I mean, it just is so half-baked. But what do you expect, man? It gets votes.
It does. Well, I mean, let's tackle one misconception. Because if you do look at the chart, I forget if Fred puts it out or whoever puts it out, but the average price of electricity in the United States has gone up. I believe price per kilowatt hour in city centers is drifting up towards like 20 cents a kilowatt hour.
But how much of that is transmission?
Well, exactly. I mean, this is, again, getting to the core of the problem. Like, what is the problem? Is it lack of investment years ago in transmission and other stuff, correct? Mm-hmm.
Well, I think it's transmission now goes towards building out new renewable generation in places that want to do ESG stuff. And new renewable generation doesn't actually increase the overall capacity factor of a grid to meet peak demand, because it might not be there when you need it. And then you have a disincentive to actually build reliable thermal generation, nuclear generation, coal generation, because all of those generators run close to around the clock and don't ramp down. And so when those generators have to endure long periods of low pricing from excess renewables, it kind of corrodes their economic return. So it's look, I'm not going to say that if we increase electricity demand by 5x that it's not going to drive up prices. Sure, that it makes sense, but the places that have the highest power prices have the worst transmission planning and modeling and investment case, like California. You know, Texas has the lowest prices, and we have the fastest growing renewable sector and an excellent market-based power economy. So it's, you can have growth, you can grow your transmission base, you can have cheap energy. It all kind of works together.
Yeah, no, I think ERCOT, I mean, is the shining example that everybody should try to follow. I think I read in the headline, correct me if I'm wrong, but they're spinning up a 453 megawatt nat gas plant outside of Houston, too. And they're just
there's so much going on there. It's testing the limits of Texas business-friendly policy. You know, it's just everyone's a data center developer now. Everyone's got a behind-the-meter power plant. There's 350 gigawatts of power in the queue on an 85 gigawatt system. And yeah, I mean, it's madness, but people are eating, man. The state is eating. Tax revenue is going to go up. A lot of that data center investment is going to go right to school district budgets. You know, property tax goes, I think, like 90 cents on, 90 basis points of our property tax goes to the school district. So it is. And if you're an electric cooperative, your adder on your power as a data center goes directly back to, as a rebate to all the residential customers. So there are a bunch of really good models in Texas, specifically in rural Texas, that are going to be like home runs for these communities just because they have power and kind of a can-do attitude.
Yeah. What, like, because I've obviously sit on the board of a miner exploring AI computes. I've been sort of behind the scenes, ear close to the ground, watching this AI data center build out happen. Like you mentioned, there's 350 gigawatts of people in the queue for a grid that has 85 gigawatts on it. And it's just, are you seeing, like when I'm observing, it seems like a lot of what was happening in 21 and 22 in Bitcoin mining, where people saw this gold rush that was incited by the Chinese mining ban, and they were, mm-hmm. everybody and their mother said, okay, all this hash rate's going to have to move let's land it in the United States. And many people who had nothing to do with mining at the time, their eyes lit up and they became power and infrastructure experts overnight.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like, I think, in the AI space, that is happening, and arguably on a level that may be an order of magnitude larger than what we experienced in the Bitcoin mining space.
So I don't disagree about your general characterization that it's a frenzy. And I think a gold rush is a great way to put it. And I have no disagreement there. And surely that will die down. So let's break out. Let's start by sort of comparing mining to mining activity and mining investment to AI data center activity investment. You know, in mining, when the Chinese mining ban happened, Bitcoin was in the midst of a big bull run. I think the price of Bitcoin was around 60K and it had rallied significantly from 5,000 to 7,000 in 2020 to 70,000 in early 2021. Then China banned mining. So you had 12x price expansion and then 50% of the network dropped off. So mining economics were 24x within a 12-month period. If you were mining at scale, your profitability looked incredible. It's commodity production. High prices are the cure for high prices. And then what we saw thereafter was a massive expansion in hash rate and a deployment in capital that was underwritten based on that period of economics, culminating in, you know, 12 to 18 months later, FTX went bankrupt and Bitcoin was trading 17,000, and there were bankruptcies throughout the mining industry. So it was the economics of Bitcoin mining can change so quickly via price and difficulty that capital was not prudent underwriting. In AI data centers, you're signing a 10 to 15 year lease with an investment grade entity that is a very solid lease, such that you can finance it with 80% debt. You have that dynamic, which is totally different because you're locking in the economics for 15 years, which is fantastic. Separately, you have this birth of a new commodity. The commodity is digital labor, and digital labor can be used to replace or complement human labor in an explosive number of use cases. And digital labor is in price discovery right now. Digital labor is not commoditized. You know, a token of compute in an Anthropic model is not the same as a token of compute in a DeepSeek model or a Grok model. It's all different. So there's no fungibility in the commodity yet. And many of the producers of that digital labor commodity are producing at a loss, and they're producing at a loss to acquire users and market share, or perhaps they want more data from users to improve their models. They want more direct user feedback. There could be a world where they value that. You know, I don't know for sure how they're making decisions. And so this new commodity is being born. We're in price discovery on it. We are in a commodification phase where eventually some standards will emerge. And at some point in the next 10 years, it probably will trade close to its marginal cost of production. And there will be bankruptcies from over-levered players. Maybe some of these leases will get broken and it will be litigation. And for sure, there will be a correction. But I do think that due to the nature of the leasing activity and the fact that you can lock in these revenues for long periods of time, and the fundamental demand structure on this commoditized digital labor tokens, you know, as long as you sail through this volatility somewhat prudently and you're mindful of who your counterparties are on some of these long-term contracts, I think generally speaking, people who are rushing in right now have a better chance to end up in a good spot.
I would agree there. So, freaks, this report was brought to you by our good friends at BitKey. Guys, things happen, things get lost. You need to replace your phone, life happens, and BitKey has been designed with this in mind. So if you're looking for the easiest way to secure your Bitcoin off the exchange, go get a BitKey. It doesn't come with any seed phrases. There's no single point of failure. It's a 2 or 3 multisig. You have your device, you have the mobile app, and Block stores a key in the server. So you have collaborative multisig there. On top of that, the new BitKey has a screen, so you can actually see and verify what you're approving. You can look at transactions, addresses, account changes. The difference between trusting and knowing has been built into the new BitKey with the screen. They have chained code delegation and other advanced features like inheritance, recovery. If you're looking to get your Bitcoin off exchange, you haven't done so, and you're looking for the easiest way to do that, go get a BitKey. You can use our code today, TFTC, to get 10% off the new BitKey. So go download the BitKey app. Use the code TFTC to get 10% off the new BitKey and start your self-custody journey today. This episode has been sponsored by our good friends at BitKey.
What's up, freaks? When you take Bitcoin seriously, you start with custody. You want to control your keys, avoid single points of failure, and make sure your savings cannot disappear because you or someone else screwed up. That is what Unchained has been focused on since 2016. Unchained is the leader in collaborative multi-sig custody and Bitcoin financial services that keep you in control. They secure over $12 billion in Bitcoin for more than 12,000 clients. That means about 1 out of every 200 Bitcoin sits inside an Unchained vault. Their model is simple. You hold 2 keys, they hold 1 key. And it always takes 2 keys to move Bitcoin, meaning their single key can't access your Bitcoin on its own. Just resilient, shared custody that gives you institutional-grade security while keeping you sovereign. Unchained also lets you trade straight from your vault, access Bitcoin-backed commercial loans, open a Bitcoin IRA where you hold your own keys, and set up personal, business, trust, or retirement vaults. They even offer inheritance solutions built for long-term hodlers. Or opt for the highest level private client service with Unchained Signature and get a dedicated account manager, discounted trading fees, exclusive access to events and features, and much, much more. If you want a partner that helps you secure and grow your Bitcoin without giving up control, go to unchained.com and use the code TFTC10 at checkout to get 10% off your new Bitcoin multisig vault. That's TFTC10 at unchained.com.
No, especially when you consider where we are just on the demand curve. Like the agentic economy just launched, what, 5 months ago, 6 months ago, maybe, depending on who you talk to. Some will say October of last year with Opus 4.5, and probably less than 0.5% of the population is even aware, and less than that has probably even tried to implement this. And then you think we haven't even got to robotics yet. Robotics is going to need insane amount of compute. It looks like the regulatory barriers for full self-driving with Tesla, Robotaxi, Waymo, they're beginning they're about to be unleashed. If you think of the demand for these tokens, I can't even fathom like what it's going to look like 5 years from now. And so like you're going to have consistent demand. I guess the big question is, How much more efficient do we become with the different types of tokens? To your point there about the commodification of tokens, I actually had a really interesting conversation with Haley from Luxor when we were in Austin for the Bitcoin takeover last month. And I think the conclusion that we came to is that right now, like the compute, it's like different grades of crude oil, like sweet, sour, light, heavy. Mm. And data centers catering to particular types of computer, like the refineries. We were running with that analogy. Interested to hear your thoughts on that, if you think that's directionally correct.
It's not a bad analogy at all. And I would say, I actually think that that ASICs are almost a better analogy, but even so, it's incomplete. It's the thing that it reminds me of is some early days of GPU mining. Some of these GPU mined shitcoins like Grin, where
sorry to hear that.
Cormint launched as a GPU mine. We were in upstate New York. We didn't have competitive electricity costs, so we had to be a GPU proof of work miner. And we mined this coin called Grin in 2019, and you mined it with a GPU. And the reason why I think it's analogous is because this token launched and there was price discovery in the token. So you had a fluctuating token price. And then you had difficulty increasing from people who were adding new compute to the network generally to pursue mining of the token and to hash towards it. And then you had a third dynamic, which was the software that was mining this new algorithm, this new proof of work algorithm, was improving in such a way that existing compute was able to get you a better product, you know, more hashes without doing anything to your hardware. And so during that time, you just didn't want to be caught short difficulty in any way. And in the case of right now with these frontier labs, whoever has the best model, which has the highest quality of pre-training and parameter size and all the variables that make a new model better and more performant, they release that model and they're able to acquire all these new users. There's a separate dynamic of sort of, are you going to keep those users once you get them into your ecosystem? What's their long-term value? And if you give them a bunch of compute at a loss, you know, how do you think about your customer acquisition costs there? But it's, I don't hate the crude oil grade analogy. I just think it's actually more complex than that, because the, with crude oil grades, you just need to have a refinery set up to handle a specific type of crude. It's basically useless if you have the wrong kind of crude going into a specific type of refinery. With this AI compute, I mean, the quality difference between even models a year ago and today is so different that it's so different and it's changing so fast that I think some people are rightly calling into question the investment strategy of the frontier labs. Like, well, what's your plan here? Are you just going to keep spending tons and tons of money on training data centers to build a bigger model? And, you know, is the new massive training model worth the expense of acquiring those users? And we'll know the answer in a few years. But I think it's still a big open question at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, I was watching the, Brad Gerstner conversation with Gavin Baker that dropped yesterday. And I think Gavin brought up, I think Noam Brown, from OpenAI put out this thought experiment. Like to your point, like, we don't even know how smart these models actually are because we've never run one. Like 4.8, nobody's ever run it for a year straight. Like I've done a agentic run for a year straight with that to see how smart it actually is, because they got out Fable 5, and like arguably they're going to move straight to Mythos if they figure out how to get comfortable with unleashing the full power of that model. And so, like, if you're continually trying to progress the models and get smarter models, like, you actually don't know how smart the previous model can actually be.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And also, I do think that there is a part of this that is divorced from economic reality, almost in a religious way, where the richest and most powerful companies and the people who lead those companies in the richest and most powerful state, America, are chasing this godlike, divine intelligence moment. And they're all competing with each other. The way that they talk about it is almost like a gospel, in especially if, you know, if you read Dario Amodei's blog posts and books, he speaks about it as if it has divine characteristics and hopes that it has a divine benevolence. Hopefully it's a New Testament God, not an Old Testament God. And I think that there's almost this awe of, well, of course we have to spend all of our money on compute, and who cares? We have it. This is the last thing. There's egos caught up in it. There's this divinity aspect, and now there are some profits. You know, thankfully, Anthropic finally is generating it what looks like a healthy, positive gross margin, and that will underwrite the next couple $1 trillion that are spent in this thing. We are in a unique moment in time, for sure.
Sup, freaks? This rip was brought to you by our good friends at Ligos Finance, Celsius, BlockFi, FTX. They took your Bitcoin and gambled it away. Ligos can't because they never hold it. Non-custodial lending on Bitcoin's base layer. Your keys, your collateral. It's verifiable on-chain. Go to Ligos.finance. Tell them that TFTC sent you.
All right, freaks. You know me. You know I don't take sponsor money from products I wouldn't use myself. So listen up. The Aven Bitcoin Visa card is one of the most interesting things I've seen in the Bitcoin lending space in a long time. Here's the deal. You can get a line of credit up to $1 million backed by your Bitcoin without selling a single sat. No games, no annual fees, no minimum draws, and your Bitcoin is custodied by BitGo, which is one of the most trusted names in digital asset security. Aven never lends it out. There's no rehypothecation. You stay in control. And guess what? You can lock in a fixed rate for up to 10 years. That's 10 times longer than most lenders out there. Or go interest only for up to 5 years. Rates start at 7.99% APR for a product that lets you keep your stack and still access liquidity. It's hard to beat. I mean, the duration in the rates is the best I've seen in the market to date. You also get 2% unlimited cash back every time you use the card. Spend fiat, keep your Bitcoin, the whole game. If you've been stacking for years and you need liquidity without triggering the taxable event, this is worth a serious look. Go to aven.com/Bitcoin. That's AVEN.com/Bitcoin. Check it out.
Yeah, a couple things there. One, it was interesting that Anthropic felt compelled to go visit the Pope. and you know, I was actually having a conversation off the record with a buddy a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking about how injecting the Bible or Bible verses into post-training has a way to push the models to be more benevolent, to your point.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you had, I can't remember, some aggrieved Silicon Valley VC was quoting Dario's, the last couple of paragraphs of Dario's Machines of Loving Grace essay. And I think it was Bill Gurley, and he was specifically pointing out some language where it's like, we hope that the AI that we build happens to value a certain kind of human, and it is a machine of loving grace, yada, 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 which I appreciate his directness. I think he's trying his best, Dario is, and trying to translate what he's seeing into an appropriate level of cautionary guidance for the species. You have to recognize he's in an impossible position. And no matter what, if you're doing something that significant at that scale and making so much money at the same time, probably 50% of the population at least is going to hate you. And that's just kind of what comes with the territory of that role. I guess.
Yeah, I'm a bit worried about his association with the effective altruism movement.
Yeah, rightfully so. Rightfully so. And hopefully that group has learned from some of the flawed thought experiments of their previous celebrated members. But yeah. I think there's a lot of, you know, there's good reason to be worried. I'm just an optimist. I think it's all going to be okay. I would prefer that this technology gets built in America. I don't think there's any way you can put the genie back in the bottle here and stop people from using this technology. And, you know, it's your job as a young person who has a family to support or a company that depends on him or her to just try to get as close to the front of the tip of the spear of knowledge in this industry, so that you can make the best decisions possible or avoid bad decisions. And you could put your head in the sand and be a hater and be a Luddite, or you could do that. And I think the former path is oriented around protecting your ego potentially. Mm-hmm. And the latter path is the path of humility, the path of greater understanding and learning. And that's the path that I want to take. So just like when I discovered Bitcoin, I had to do the same thing. Like, you have to get right to the front of this thing and try to understand it as best you can.
Yeah. No, I tweeted out this morning, I've never been more bullish on humanity. I don't buy the permanent underclass meme. And to your point, like, I've done my best to be on the tip of the spear in terms of interacting with this technology. And we've been building we've been building like a company brain at TFTC using agentic flows. Mm-hmm. It's just so much fun. And you can see, and you see, touch, feel. It's like, oh, this is real. And it makes it much easier to completely discard the Luddites or the haters who say there's nothing here. It's like, well, have you actually touched it? Have you seen it? Have you experienced its power?
How has your audience generally kind of, what's your view on where they land on this issue? Because those are, you know, you have a loyal and fierce group of acolytes.
Very receptive. We actually have data on this because we do a Typeform survey for anybody who signs up for the newsletter. Not everybody responds to it, but we've gotten thousands of responses in the last 3 months. We have sort of an open-ended, like, what type of content would you like us to cover more of? Mm-hmm. And AI is, I think, 60% of people like AI content. And I think, to your point about, you had that feeling around Bitcoin, I think many Bitcoiners, particularly if you've been in Bitcoin for a certain period of time, are fine-tuned to be more receptive to this type of disruptive technology. And so I actually think my audience, the TFTC audience, is more attuned to being receptive to this stuff. And I think it shows out in the data, the survey data that we have.
Yeah, that makes sense. I wanted to ask you at some point when we talk about Sailor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's your question about Michael?
Well, I've historically been I'm going to call myself a defender and I wouldn't use the word fan, but I would say a defender and a hat tipper, where I'd say, I think his actions have been rational, smart, defensible. And I'm a hat tipper in that I'm like, good for you, man. You know, you accumulated a massive quantity of Bitcoin in this entity. You can pay yourself a salary from that entity, and you're able to add more Bitcoin to your ownership per share in that entity, like as a Bitcoiner, where I wish I thought of that. Like, I've been a big sort of a supporter. Like, why are people hating on this guy? I'm a little concerned about what he's done over the last month or two. And yeah, I would love to hear your take on it.
I think I'm very, very aligned with your perspective on it, which is I've been a hat tipper. I mean, Michael has been on the show once, and it was, I think 5 or 6 years ago at this point when we were fighting. I mean, I think I have the most combative podcast episode of Michael Saylor has ever been recorded, because it was when he was pushing the Bitcoin Mining Council. And I was very much in the camp of, we don't need this, don't cater to the ESG. Mm-hmm. Crowd, and he was very much in the, we should just appease them. And I was in a big, don't appease them. And I still stand by that. I actually think,
yeah,
my perspective and position actually played out to be the right one in the long run. But outside of that, historically, since Strategy started accumulating Bitcoin, been a hat tipper, like, hey, you're doing it, and you're utilizing this entity to acquire Bitcoin in a way that is accretive to shareholders. But to your point, like with like Stretch and all these preferreds and the narrative switching and the forward guidance strategy we'll give in an earnings call, and then quickly, and it started last year. So my antennae peaked last year after their Q2 earnings call. I forget exactly what he said, but there was something about the mechanics of the ATM and the guardrails they were putting on themselves for when they would leverage the ATM. Mm-hmm. And literally 2 weeks after that earnings call, they negged on that forward guidance. Mm-hmm.
I remember that. Yeah.
And I remember at that moment, I was like, wait a second, this is a little weird. And then obviously you have these perpetuals that have come out, Strike and Stretch. And I'm not going to pretend to know how to dissect the financial engineering and pinpoint exactly where it could blow up, but the caveman in me is just like, this seems too good to be true. And mm-hmm. That's my perspective. If you want to invest in strategy, MSTR, stretch, strike, go for it. Not my cup of tea, though.
Yeah. I think you're right to point out this call it shareholder deception started a while ago. And it's now reached I would say it is overlapping with another behavior that I think is concerning, which is, I don't think he's making good choices right now. I think that the key thing he did wrong was he bought back those preferreds, the preferred convertible debt. I mean, he bought back the convertible debt and reduced his dividend runway on all of the preferred instruments from, I think, 18 months to 6 months. And that was when the market started kind of freaking out a little bit and selling off. And then they came out with a slide deck that said, oh, well, now we can sell Bitcoin and buy USD as a fifth pillar of our strategy. And he's always said, of course, we're never going to sell Bitcoin. And we're always trying to increase sats per share. And so he's gone back on what he said he was not going to do. He made a misstep on managing their strategy and their financial position, because really what he's done now is taken a time-based concept where as long as Bitcoin goes up more than the yield that they have to pay on the preferred, then it should be an accretive strategy. And I think there's some reflexivity to it where the more that he's able to buy, the more likely that outcome becomes. But now that he's actively deceiving the shareholder base and he's made a financial misstep, I think it's the time for him to reflect. And I have a message for him. I would say, Michael, you need to channel through a quantum portal to your future self and recognize that you're in a precarious position right now. You've brilliantly financial engineered your way into a massive Bitcoin position, and you now need to figure out a way to create intrinsic value with that Bitcoin. The jig is up on the financial engineering. You can't sell the market. The more that you deceive people from here on out, the more that this will be the high water mark on your reputation. You need to figure out how to actually create cash flows or Bitcoin denominated cash flows using your stack. That's my message to him.
Yeah. And then that's always, I think, the caveman intuition in me is like, you can only financial engineer to a certain extent, but you need cash flow if you're running a business.
Well, he did it. I mean, it's like, hey, man, you got 900,000 Bitcoin. Maybe you could start a financial services company. You could do hard work. You could do a hard thing. What you did was novel, and you sold a bunch of people on this thing. Most people who bought your equity instead of Bitcoin over the last couple of years have underperformed. And now you have a financial structure that's fallible, and your only option is to sell Bitcoin or sell common stock below your MNAV. And that people are rightfully pointing out that the MNAV figure that he's using is somewhat deceptive. So he's got to, I think, stop.
Yeah.
Take the summer off, you know?
Well, that's the other question, because he was very public about it starting last year, that we're using AI to create these financial products. And like, AI, as we just described, it's very powerful. But I think if you're seeing, touching, feeling, you also know it's fallible to a certain degree too. Like right now, it's at the functionality. I mean, Fable 5 was a big jump, but 4.8, actually, when 4.8 came out, I diverted back to 4.6. I preferred 4.6, but long story short, they're just like sophisticated calculators that can give you wrong answers and mm-hmm. are a bit sycophantic. And so how much of the AI utilization to create these financial products is a machine being sycophantic to you to convince you that this is a good idea?
Yeah, totally. You got to read the room a little bit, I think. And yeah, it's Something has changed recently. I know. I'm worried. I'm worried for him.
To your point about MNAV, like Mallers asked him the question, I guess, in Prague a couple of days ago about it, and he gave a 10-minute long-winded answer that was sort of a non-answer. And then today he gave his keynote and excluded Strike from the slide of emerging Bitcoin companies, which was, I think, a bit pedantic.
Yeah. Yep. And look, the Jack's always been, you could call it like a Bitcoin vanguard, and I think he's saying what the market is feeling. He's got a platform that breaches that barrier there, which is, like, generally speaking, Sailor was supported, and there's an immune response within Bitcoin that we're not going to allow a deceptive person in our midst to go uncalled out. And he's now actively deceiving on all of his platforms in a variety of ways. And he's making financial missteps, and that, you know, he's too big to fail almost. And that should be the narrative. The narrative should be, you're fucking up, and your ego is in the driver's seat, and you're deceiving people, and you need to take a break. You need to reflect.
I would agree. We're in alignment there. And then, yeah, because I mean, now it's getting to the point too where you have like derivatives of the strategy with like Strive and SATA, and like you're beginning to build layers on top of this. And if you're deceiving,
and there are stable coins that are backed by it out there.
DeFi, yeah.
Yeah.
On Solana.
It's crazy.
It's all
good to hear. Good to hear we are aligned on so many things. What do you suppose we are not aligned on?
That's a great question. I mean, I think you've definitely pulled me more in your, I mean, we've known each other for what, almost a decade now.
Yeah,
the ordinal stuff. We were not aligned on the ordinal stuff, but I think was I proven right there? Or do you think there's a?
I will say that ordinals is obviously not a persisting phenomenon, and I don't know that I ever went on record saying that, but I did say I enjoy incremental fee revenues being paid to miners, and I do think that is a problem. Although I've moderated my views on this a little bit, which is that I think the fee market will materialize when there is more volatility in block times. And it'll be interesting to see how Bitcoin works in that era. I mean, imagine if you had to pay a big transaction fee if you wanted to get your transaction confirmed in like 3 or 4 hours. Do you think you would do that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so too. But I'll give you that one. I'm not sure what the exact nature of our disagreement was, but
well, I think it was around the fee market, so it was a layer above the core discussion, which was, are you worried about long term security budget?
I am worried about it, and my concerns have moderated a little bit, but I am definitely worried about it in that I do think people will pay high fees if this phenomenon emerges, but I wonder what the market's receptivity will be to tolerating a long-term high fee regime, and if that will persist. You know, I worry that people will try to find ways to innovate around paying high fees, and then what will the nature of the relationship between protocol and the revenue that's generated from blocks and Bitcoin miners be? What is that going to look like?
Yeah. Maybe this is naive, but I've always been under like the, we don't know what the future state is going to be. So like, I think keeping an open mind in terms of the ability of creative new use cases of Bitcoin to emerge that we can't even fathom. And I just always have this, maybe it's blind confidence and naivety, but that we're going to find a way. Or it's not like find a way to, you don't go in with the intention to increase fee revenue for miners via transaction fees just to do that. It's that Bitcoin will be so useful that I don't think you can try to engineer increased fee revenue for miners intentionally out of the box. I think the goal should be to make Bitcoin so useful on every different layer, protocol layer, layers above it, that the demand for the UTXOs. I mean, it's the conversation of Jevons paradox for compute is very, very front and center right now. It's funny watching everybody learn what Jevons paradox is in the outside world, outside of Bitcoin, because I feel like Bitcoiners have been talking about it for a while, but I do still operate under the belief that you can apply Jevons paradox to UTXOs too. And so the more that we can make UTXO usage more efficient and increase the optionality of use cases with individual UTXOs, I feel like it's going to drive demand for them in the long run. That's my intuition.
What is your view on quantum? Well, maybe we're not aligned there.
I am personally skeptical that it'll arrive on the timelines that are being put out there, if at all. However, I have become thoroughly convinced that regardless of whether or not quantum manifest, we should be preparing for new signature schemes anyway. And
yeah,
a lot of those just so happen to be quantum resistant too. I feel like the work's being done. I guess many people would argue about whether or not the urgency with which it's being done is urgent, is sufficiently urgent. I'm under the impression that it's sufficient enough for me at this point. What's your thoughts? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it does feel like the two sides of the debate are really around the nuance of it. And then maybe the more, the nastier debate that is impending is the implementation form, where there will be a lot of nerd bloodshed at, at what is the actual final form of,
I'm not going to give up
the signature.
I'm not going to give up, my perspective on this. I want yours first. Do we dump Satoshi's coins or do we freeze them?
It's a great question. I think you can't touch them personally. I just think that it's like, what are you talking about? I get it, and it sucks. You hope that, my hope is that a benevolent entity that controls the most powerful AI cracks it and burns them as a flex, like Google. Google Quantum, because it is a crime, maybe. And you can see right now, I think some of the more interesting things that you're seeing right now is people are setting the stage for legalizing that crime by claiming lost property on chain, and then they'll steal it with Quantum and they'll be like, well, this was my property, which is a very interesting little tactic.
That's the question I have, is like, are these people working on Quantum that are making these claims, or is it somebody?
I think they maybe are just imagining a time when the technology is widely available and they need to have legal title to it, or somebody steals it and then goes to them and they have legal title. And they're like, my fee is 5%. You know, like, I will clean your money and you can launder it through US bank rails because I own title to this and you have stolen it. Maybe it works like that, but that would be, I think it'd be sick if Google was just like, we are so far ahead and we cracked Satoshi's coins right to a burn wallet. Let's go, boys. That'd be great.
That would be sick. We're aligned here. I don't think you can touch Satoshi's coins. However, an interesting conversation this week in New York, I won't disclose with who, but he presented a third option, which I think many people are completely overlooking, which is Satoshi is still alive and well and actually does want to move his coins at some point in the future. And his whole argument was like, in Bitcoin, we hold Satoshi up as this deity like figure, and there's a lot of reverence for what he did by launching Bitcoin and by walking away from it. And it's like he's almost this untouchable entity that everybody looks up to. And the argument that he was making is that everybody is underappreciating him. Like, who's not to say that Satoshi has a long-term plan, is waiting for the market cap to get to a certain point at which he can begin deploying his Bitcoin to invest in things that he wants to see. Which
Did you watch that documentary, the one that came out recently?
No, I haven't watched it.
No.
I feel like I've seen
it. It was a compelling case, I would say.
Yeah,
I found it to be believable.
A lot of them are believable. A lot of the theories are believable. You can make the case for many of them, some less believable than others, but.
You should watch the documentary and see what you think. I think that the approach they took to the research was more credible and methodical than previous approaches. And
Finding Satoshi, that's what it's called, right?
I think so. Yeah, you have to go buy it on their website. So they're sort of like, I'm not going through conventional distribution channels. You can come buy it direct from me, which is kind of the way that you would do it if you released a documentary, I think. So
yeah,
you should give them a little. Little props on that. Pay your $20.
A little value for value. I'm not against that. All right. Maybe I'll rent it and watch it this weekend.
Yeah.
What else?
Did the person who provided that theory, had they watched this documentary?
I don't know. I didn't ask them. I can't say.
I'm curious about who this person is.
Yeah. Of course, the typical Bitcoiner fashion is like, I won't tell you who I think Satoshi is because I would never want to draw that attention to them. But very confident. And I just thought it was an interesting theory. I think many people are discounting that possibility that Satoshi is alive and wants to be a trillionaire philanthropist at some point in the future.
Yeah. Many of our brightest minds are distracted by AI at the moment. Probably a good time to do stuff in Bitcoin if you wanted a good development environment.
I'm very happy with where the pace of development, and I do agree that many. I think there are a certain certain subsector of the Bitcoin world that is distracted by it. But I think, I mean, a lot of the conversations I'm having is like people trying to figure out again how to be on the cutting edge of this to leverage it to effectuate the proliferation of Bitcoin technology. Because you'd be stupid not to leverage this stuff to try to build. There's so much more to do now.
Yep. And if you happen to own a bunch of powered land, you got a nice little gift dropped into your lap.
How good are you feeling right now with everything that's going on for powered land developers?
Look, I feel lucky. I would say in our marketing materials a couple of years ago, we would claim that part of the hypothesis of developing Powerland for Bitcoin was that AI compute could grow and demand for that power at scale could make the assets that we were buying for relatively cheap look like a great buy in hindsight. I did not see this coming. did not see that our company would have offers from $1 trillion companies to do deals. It's a little wild. It's also a little bit of a different skill set than I think you have as a Bitcoiner. It's a different muscle where in Bitcoin there's a sovereignty that extends also to the companies. There's a way we do business. There's just it's a very colloquial relationship, can be high trust. Some of the norms of Bitcoin and cryptocurrency would be shocking to people who come from Fortune 100 company world. So there's a part of it that is, you feel like a little bit of a sellout if you go down that road where there's so much diligence, so much compliance, so much lawyering, and then you just get a big fat check at the end. And it's like, yeah, you're being paid a little bit to sell your soul. So it's not all positive, but I would say overwhelmingly that the weight of the burden that you feel for your shareholders and your employees to deliver a positive result. And I mean, I take that very personally, and it's a heavy burden for me, where this is it's a blessing. We got lucky, and we want to do our best to capitalize on it, and overall just generally feel lucky.
Well, I mean, luck is what is it? Preparation and fate meeting.
Opportunity meets preparation.
Yes, opportunity meets preparation. There we go. And I think out of many people in the Bitcoin mining space, your preparation was better than most, which is evident by the low cost mining and the ability to survive through multiple cycles that you've shown. One last question, though. I mean, building on what you just described about sort of interacting with these Fortune 100 companies, what can they learn from what we've done in Bitcoin? And do you think we can pull them more towards our worldview via interacting with them more at this intersection of compute and power?
I would say, directly speaking, for mining, you know, the way that we built mining data centers was, you're building to extract the commodity out of the input commodity as cheaply as possible. You're building an electricity conversion machine where you're trying to convert electricity into Bitcoins as cheaply as possible. You can build a data center for $100,000 a megawatt, including labor, including all materials and labor from a high voltage input source to the plug. You can do it. And you can run a data center for 2 cents a kilowatt hour. You can even run it for free. And the more that you embrace flexible operations and invite downtime into your design philosophy, the lower that your total cost of ownership will be. Fortune 100 companies and the style of data centers that they build were oriented around, I think, as a core principle, we don't go down ever. And the reason why is because if AWS goes down, or if Instagram goes down, the amount of revenue loss that they lose is probably thousands of dollars of megawatt hour equivalent. You know, it is astronomical, because it's their reputation, it's commerce streams, it's, you know, frustrated users and all of those things. And so the data center design philosophy for those Fortune 100 companies reflects that. And we're in commodity production. Like this type of compute is different. You are producing commodities here, and when you're producing commodities, it's a marginal cost of production business. And so I think that Bitcoin mining data center developers who were oriented around building and operating data centers at the lowest possible cost are going to be in a good position to innovate in the AI data center space, where you have people coming from this sort of no downtime paradigm, and then you have these sort of garbage collector Bitcoin miners who are like building these really low cost chicken wire data centers. And like, there's a middle point there that's going to be, we could end up in a good spot there as an industry. I mean, we already have. The industry is landing this pivot very well.
I agree. And I think, and on this, because I know you have a tight hour here, Colossus won. It was amazing watching how Elon and crew built that, because they did it, what, in 100 days? And when we finally got a look at how they did it, it was like, oh, they acted like a Bitcoin miner, daisy chaining gen sets, putting battery walls on the inside, and just thought like a scrappy Bitcoin miner.
Yeah, it was remarkable. I mean, I think that if you have all the stuff, you can build these data centers fast. If you have to buy it through the supply chain, you know, there's parts of the supply chain that just take longer. We would build Bitcoin mining. Our best Bitcoin mining data center was like 110 days at $104,000 a megawatt built. that was the best we ever did. But there are parts of that that you just can't control, like supply chain and timing. And so I think that like Elon definitely nailed that. But if you need to order everything from scratch and you don't have it in inventory, 100 days is not possible due to some supply chain timing. But I mean, he's a badass. I'm a fan and definitely setting the pace as usual. I hope we're not competing with him. I see all this like SpaceX leasing data center compute and I'm like, fuck, man, I do not want to compete with Elon.
Yeah, you do. Iron sharpens iron, you know.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. And we can hold our own. I mean, we're scrappy, but
you always want to compete with the best. It's not worth being in it if you're not competing.
I would rather compete with the worst. Hey, I just want to win. And competing against a person like Elon, who has so much more resource and so much more just like raw intellectual firepower in himself and around him, it's tough, man. It'd be daunting, but I think there's plenty of wood to chop out here. We need a lot of compute. West Texas is going to be a great place to do it, so we're excited.
Well, I'm pumped for you, brother. Appreciate you taking some time to catch up today, because I think this is a topic that many people are still trying to wrap their heads around, and I think you're one of the sharpest minds within Bitcoin that's playing at this intersection can actually articulate it. So appreciate that.
Yeah, let's do it again. This was fun. Thank you very much for having me.
All right. Peace and love, freaks. Okay.
Thank you for listening to this episode of TFTC. If you've made it this far, I imagine you got some value out of the episode. If so, please share it far and wide with your friends and family. We're looking to get the word out there. Also, wherever you're listening, whether that's YouTube, Apple, Spotify, make sure you like and subscribe to the show. And if you can leave a rating on the podcasting platforms, that goes a long way. Last but not least, if you want to get these episodes a day early and ad free, make sure you download the Fountain podcasting app. You can go to fountain.fm to find that. $5 a month gets you every episode a day early, ad free, helps the show, gives you incredible value. So please consider subscribing via Fountain as well. Thank you for your time. And until next time.